Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful, beautiful Wednesday. This is Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm really glad to be here with you for the next hour. And I have a wonderful guest joining me today, Jeff Negrin, who is the founder and director of The Growing Seed, which is a business that designs and installs and maintains vegetable gardens for residential and commercial properties. And I'll tell you more about him in a little while. And of course, I have a recipe to share with you. I've been having so much fun making raw desserts for one of my clients. So I'll share one of those with you. But I just want to share with you what's going on in my garden. I'm actually at a little struggle juncture right now. I have green peppers, red peppers, and eggplants in my garden that I planted weeks ago. I got them as seedlings, and they have not grown 1 inch since I've put them in the soil. And I am baffled. I don't really know what to do. And so I have some interns working with me. Went out today, and we bought some new compost and manure to add to the soil, as well as some fish emulsion, and which I've already given to them before. And I'm just, you know, not sure. I don't know whether it was whether it's some of the extreme heat or some of the extreme rain that we've been having, or whether my soil is just depleted of minerals after years of gardening. But my tomatoes are doing great. My Mizuna greens are doing great. Of course, my snow peas and sugar snap peas are doing great. My bok choy is great. So the greens seem to be doing really great. But for some reason, I would say it's the nightshade vegetables, but it's just the eggplant and the peppers. The tomatoes are doing fine. The potatoes are starting to sprout as well. My basil's not doing great. Anyway, it's really a miraculous thing. You know, learning about the garden and trying to understand, all the interactions between the microbes and the chemistry and the, you know, love factor and everything that goes into making your plants grow. It's a learning process, and I'm really fortunate to have some great interns working with me that are helping me research and struggle through it. And I will keep you all posted on what's going on. My peach tree is holding on to its fruit. You know, the borers are still oozing, and I don't really know what to do with that. I'm going to try another tea tree paste, or you know, a biodynamic tree paste that I made last year, and I'm going to give it another try. And we'll see what happens. Blueberries are coming along, raspberries are coming along, pears are coming along. My apples I have one apple on all three apple trees, so I don't know what the story is with that. They're young trees still, so I think, you know, some birds got to it early on, along with the cherry trees. So it is a work in progress, but I'm really happy to be doing this work. It feels like the right work to be doing, and I look forward to sharing the bounty. I actually am very happy to say that I've scheduled a series of cooking classes in August, and they will be 4 Thursday evenings in August. And the first date is August 2nd, which will be a vegan cooking class. And the second date is August 9th, and that will be raw cooking. And I have a woman, Okima, joining me for that. She runs the Live Island Cafe out in Huntington, and she is a expert raw chef, and I'm happy to have her joining me on that one. August 23rd is just vegetarian, so there will be some dairy in that meal. And August 30th, I'm actually going to do some local fish, along with, of course, each class will have delicious fresh vegetables harvested from the garden. And, you know, the participants, we will all get to do some of that harvesting together. So I hope some of you or many of you can join me for the cooking series. Again, it's Thursdays in August, and you can send me an email at bhavani@ieatgreen.com to register. Lots of other great events going on around town. Of course, it is the Edible Eat Drink Local Week starting this past week, June 23rd, and it goes through the 30th. So go onto the website for that, Edible Eat Drink Local Week, and find out what restaurants are participating and check that out. There's lots of outdoor films going on throughout the city. I've been highlighting one at that takes place at the Socrates Sculpture Park in Long Island City. And it starts July 4th, and it's every Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. And so you can go to the website for that and find out the schedule. But, you know, check out all the different outdoor events going on in the city. There's films all over the place, and there are just too many to list. So you can research that on the internet, but a lot of them have to do with local food. There's documentaries. The reason I like the one at Socrates Park is there's always some local food vendors that are sponsoring the event and sharing their delicious food. And there's usually live music and dance there as well. Very excited, on Saturday, July 14th, there is a seafood throwdown happening at the Grand Army Plaza. And my guest next week is, Brett Tolley, who is, one of the community organizers and policy advocates for the Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance. And they will be there, as one of the sponsors of that event. And he'll tell us more about it next Wednesday. Next Wednesday, of course, is July 4th. But we will be here anyway, sharing a great show with you. So July 4th, and if you are out celebrating festivities and you can't catch us on July 4th, you know you can always catch it in the archives. But he'll be talking to us about the seafood throwdown at the Green Market. So check that out. July 15th, there's foraging with Slow Food New York City in Prospect Park with Letta Meredith, and she was a guest on my show, and she's a wonderful woman and has a lot of knowledge to share with all of us. So if you can join that, that's July 15th, and you can go to the Slow Food New York City website to find out more about that. There's our first Brooklyn Permaculture Meetup on July 16th. And there's so many things that I put on my website and send out in a newsletter each week. So if you do not receive my newsletter and you would like to, please send me an email, Bhavani@iegreen, that you would like to be added to this email list. On July 25th, out in Huntington at the Cinema Arts Center, Long Island is sponsoring a Long Island Film Festival for Occupy Wall Street, supporting their work. And there will be a film and a speaker and some great food, and it will just be a wonderful time to come together with other Long Islanders supporting the Occupy movement. And we also have the silk screeners from the Occupy movement coming to the screening, and they will be designing a custom Long Island Occupy logo. So bring a blank T-shirt with you and come on down for that. So what else is going on? There's lots of things going on in the news having to do with our right to know about GMO foods. And it seems like the bill did not get passed in the Senate, but people are still fighting to get that through. So your right to know about what foods you are buying and whether or not the foods you are buying are genetically modified should be everyone's right. And we need to let our politicians know that that's important to us. So please send letters to your senators and congressmen letting them know that you support the right to know and you support GMO labeling. There's also a statewide call-in to, yesterday was the big day, to Governor Cuomo's office to let him know that you do not support the expansion of fracking in New York State. And he is set to approve fracking in the southern tier of New York State. And there's a lot of people banding together to protest that. So please check out Food and Water Watch. Check out River Keeper. Lots of different websites you can check out to find out what's going on as far as fracking in New York State goes. But the bottom line is it's not good. It's bad news, and we need to make sure that that does not happen. So please join in on that. Also, I don't know if you guys saw that the report that vaccinated children have a much higher rate of illness and allergies than those children that are not vaccinated. I thought that was pretty interesting. Also, the Environmental Working Group just came out with their 2012 Shopper's Guide to Pesticides and Produce. So the EWG.org is a great website all of you should have as one of your favorite pages. And they not only list the pesticides in produce and which vegetables to avoid, they also say tell you which vegetables are the least sprayed. And they also have a great, great report on sunscreen. And I always like to remind everybody out there that you need to think about the sunscreen you put on your body. As your skin is your largest organ, it absorbs everything that you put on it. And so too often we don't give enough thought as to what chemicals we're putting on our body. And that really matters. So go on to the Environmental Working Group and check out their sunscreen report. And buy the sunscreens that are least toxic, and you'll be doing yourself and your family a big, big favor. Okay, so before I invite Jeff on to talk to us about the work he's doing with his gardens, I'd like to share this recipe with you. As I said before, I've been making lots of raw desserts for my client who is fighting cancer, and she's also not fighting, but she has celiac, and so she has to avoid gluten in her diet. And so I have been making some raw desserts for her, and I'm enjoying it tremendously, and they are so good that it's really exciting. So I'm really happy to share it with you. And I have to tell you, I was not a big believer in these desserts. And as I've played around with different recipes and really picked what I think is the best from many to create my own, I'm really happy to share them with you. So this one is a raw lemon strawberry cheesecake. For the crust, I used a cup of macadamia nuts, a cup of raw almonds, a cup of organic dates, a half a cup of dried, unsweetened organic coconut, and just a pinch of sea salt. And it's amazing, just that one little pinch of sea salt really makes a difference in the crust. And so you're going to process all of those ingredients in the food processor until they're finely chopped. You're going to, do the nuts first. Do the nuts, the macadamia nuts and the almonds. When they're finely chopped, then add the dates and the coconut and keep processing it until it all starts clumping together and you have one big ball of gooey crust mixture. And then you're going to press that down into the bottom of a cheesecake pan. I use a springform pan. If you don't have that, you can use a regular pie pan. But I use a springform pan and I lay it down evenly all the way on the bottom, and then I work the crust up the side. And so that it looks professional and looks nice, I use my two hands when I'm pressing it up the side, and one hand is pressing down on the top of the crust while the other hand is pressing in on the side. And by doing this, I am creating a nice uniform edge to the crust all the way along, so it's even and it will look nice when I take off the edge of the springform pan. And then I am going to make the filling. And the filling consists of 2 cups of cashews. Now, you want to soak the cashews in water for 3 hours. Some recipes will tell you you need to do it overnight. That has not been my experience. And since I am so rarely planning that far ahead, 3 hours seems to work just fine. So I soak the cashews for 3 hours. I also press out a cup of lemon juice using fresh organic lemons. 3/4 cup of agave. You can also use maple syrup if you'd like. 3/4 cup of coconut oil. 1 tablespoon of vanilla. And 1/4 cup of water. And I start by pulsing the cashews in the food processor until they're smooth. Then I add just a little bit of the water. 1/4 cup of the water to make a smooth paste. Then I add the lemon juice, the agave, and the coconut oil, and the vanilla. And I process it, and then I take a spatula and I scoop up any of the parts on the edge that have splashed up that are not smooth and pureed. And then I pureed some more until all of it is really smooth and fluffy. And then I pour the filling mixture into the pie crust, and I put it into the freezer for an hour before I add the strawberry topping. And the strawberry topping couldn't be easier. It's also just pureeing 2 cups of strawberries. You can either use frozen strawberries or fresh, and a quarter cup of agave, and process that, and then you can put it on top of the cheesecake. And you can leave the cheesecake in the freezer and pull it out an hour or two before serving it, and that is it. You can also decorate it with some fresh strawberries, which I did. I just cut the strawberries into slices and just made a nice design on the top. And also in my weekly newsletter, I usually put some pictures of the recipes that I'm sharing with you each week. So that's another reason to sign up for the newsletter. Okay. So I hope you check out these raw desserts that I've been sharing with you, and please give me feedback. I'd love to know how it's going. And if any of you have any questions today and you would like to call in, the number here in the studio is 888-874-4888. And you can call in and ask any questions you'd like. So Jeff Negron, my guest today, is the founder and operator of The Growing Seed, which is a for-profit business that designs and installs and maintains vegetable gardens for residential and commercial properties. 4 years ago, Jeff felt that his community would benefit from the services of a business dedicated solely to vegetable and edible gardens. And over the past year, his business has transitioned more to commercial gardens and restaurant vegetable gardens than residential, but he still does some residential as well. He's also been volunteering for the edible school gardens in the East End, working with Slow Food East End, and he's also on Saturdays at the Sag Harbor Farmers Market. He's also one of the recipients of a grant from Slow Food East End for the Joshua Levine Grant Award that hired 3 farmers to help get vegetable gardens off the ground at some local East End schools, and he's also been doing that. So I'm really happy to welcome Jeff on. Jeff, are you there with us?
I'm here. Thank you.
Good. So what inspired you to first start The Growing Seed?
Let's see. Well, it was the economy. Everything kind of was on hold out here in the East End of Long Island regarding new projects, and I was working for a landscape company doing full service. I was doing the marketing and purchasing for the company. And at that time, I realized that may be the good opportunity to start this kind of small idea and to see where it goes. So that's initially how it got started.
So you were already living out on the East End?
Yeah, you know, I have been living out here for about 9 years, and so I didn't want to leave the area. And I knew that this community is very healthy with food and very eco-friendly and willing to try new things. So this idea of just starting vegetable gardens was just a very organic approach to just doing something different and possibly trying to teach other people at the same time.
Uh-huh. And what was your experience with gardens prior to starting this? You said you were working with a landscape company, but you were doing the marketing end. Were you also doing some of the gardening end?
Yeah, you know, my trip through horticulture has allowed me through career to really explore a lot about what is horticulture. I worked for a greenhouse doing sales and greenhouse growing. I've worked retail at a garden center. I'm a professionally designer, floral designer. So, when I started working for the landscape company, the idea was that they needed to expand their brand, and so I offered to help out. It was just something different within the horticulture that keeps me near, but also kind of gets me involved with other projects.
And was the landscaper also doing things organically, because I know...
Every landscaper out here does offer that service. You know, if you're a client and you want a vegetable garden, every landscaper will offer that service. What I am doing differently is offering a very select service that caters directly with that client. That is entailed from learning, educational type of model, where I'm working with the family, especially the kids, and teaching them just basic seeds, how to grow, what to do with the plants, how to use them, And that was the service that I was providing, which kind of separated me from everybody else out here.
Uh-huh. But recently you were telling me that you've been shifting from doing as much residential more towards restaurant gardens and commercial gardens. When did you make that switch, and how come?
Well, my focus was kind of slow, to be honest. I didn't know what to expect. All I did was just hand out some flyers outside of my neighborhood, and one or two people called here and there. So obviously that wasn't going to satisfy how to make a living out here. So I took a job with a public garden, which was just awarded to the Peconic Land Trust. It's the first for them to inherit the 5-acre public garden. And the opportunity for me to work with them kind of just shifted towards that. They needed somebody right away, so I supplemented my income working for Bridge Gardens and just doing the side garden business on the side. Eventually, I just met up with a few farmers. I started working the farmers market, had a chance to just start a dialogue to tell people what I wanted to do, and that led to more invitations. And eventually, I met a restaurant owner who is in Sag Harbor who said, listen, I want to do this. I have this idea, and I would like your help. So that's how it got started for me to be invited to a restaurant. And with the visual aspect of it, other restaurants are kind of seeing that. So that's how I kind of started being invited to different restaurants. So I have 4 restaurants currently that I'll be maintaining and harvesting and scheduling for crops.
Can you share with us what restaurants those are? Because my listeners all like to eat local organic food. So knowing that the vegetables are being harvested right there, fresh from their garden, is definitely a sales point for me and for most of my listeners.
Yeah, I'd be happy to tell you. But first, I'd also like to mention that Sag Harbor and the East End of Long Island are very farmer conscious. I get that question a lot. Where is the food? We have some pretty knowledgeable local growers out here. So, that being said, the one restaurant that I was referring to was Little Estia's Kitchen in Sag Harbor, South Fork Kitchen in Bridgehampton, and Nick and Tony's Restaurant in East Hampton. And the new one is Tom Coliglio's Topping Rose Inn, which will open up in Bridgehampton this summer.
Topping Rose?
Topping Rose Inn, yeah.
Uh-huh.
So he'll be occupying that space later this summer, opening up for hopefully before Labor Day. And that'll be a full-time restaurant, and we're opening up a 10,000-square-foot restaurant garden there.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, it's a big space. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to the challenge. I think Tom and Ruff's ideas are, we're going to be shipping some stuff into the craft restaurants. So that'll be kind of exciting to explore that type of logistical type of maneuver.
Oh, so you think you'll be growing not just for the new restaurant in Bridgehampton, but also for the ones in the city?
Possibly, because 10,000 square feet is a lot of space. And I have been practicing for the past couple of years this kind of companion planting and really tight space gardening. And I can pack a lot of stuff into a small area.
Uh-huh.
That being said, I'd also, have to go about it kind of slow. So the idea right now is just to grow some basic crops for the restaurant, for the inn. And, if there is a overabundance of something, we'll have to find some way to pickle it or use it in some other manner that we could use it in the future.
Uh-huh. What kind of potential does 10,000 square foot garden grow? Like how many pounds do you think you can net from that? Any idea?
I don't know. That's a very good question. I've been playing around with those numbers. As my background explains, is that I'm just a gardener, and it slowly has expanded my square footage. So I'm learning the math right now as to, how much pounds of carrots am I going to get out of a 50-foot row, if I do 3-inch spacing and, with all the other parameters. So I've been relying on Johnny's seed list. They usually give you in the catalog, just some rough numbers in case somebody asks that I can get at least, 40 pounds of broccoli in a 100-foot row. There are formulas for you to use and reference, but honestly, I don't really have those exact numbers yet. It's a very detailed collaboration between the chef and myself and the harvester, which is sometimes myself or sometimes an assistant in the kitchen that, you know, it takes time to obviously harvest, but now we have to weigh it and figure out what space was used up for that and, you know, how many lines, how long did it last in the kitchen, how did we use it in the kitchen. So there's a lot of communication, which is probably the biggest key to working with a restaurant.
Which is
fun. You know, that's part of the challenge.
Now, 10,000 square foot space, is that 100 by 100 or?
Yeah, it's roughly 125 by 75 is the actual space. But I'm rounding it. I'm rounding the corners a little bit, save myself some, you know, long-term math there.
Yeah, that's a big space. Do you think you and an assistant will be able to farm all that without other helpers, or you need...
Yeah, you know, I have one other assistant. I am an assistant Boy Scout leader in the village here in Sag Harbor, and James has taken a liking to the gardening, and he's from a farming family historically, so he's into it, and he's learning a lot about vegetables, so him and I will be maintaining the property, and, you know, I'm just going about it slow. I don't want to fill in all the space, so that's what I'm going to use cover crops to fill in that empty space. There's still plans for a big herb garden, and herb plants can entail a very long list of plants from perennial to annual to self-seeding perennial. So I have plenty of space to play with, so it'll be fun to design the farm to not just be a straight row farm, but also to kind of invite people to walk through the garden and through the farm lines of food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be fun.
You know, and with that obligation, I don't have to fill in all the space. I can just throw in a whole row of cover crop, and, you know, cover crops have their nice look to them, and they keep the soil healthy, but they also look good up top. So, you know, that's an easy one for me.
Right, right. So I know you told me you also were doing the Hamptons Food Cart Rally at the Hayground School. What is that, and what will you be doing there?
Yeah, the Hayground School is an amazing school. I work.
Is it a public school or a private school?
It's a private school. It's you know, you'll have to have Jon Snow, who I would encourage you to call regarding his what he does at his school. But I'm right across the street from him at Bridge Gardens, the public garden that I work at occasionally, and so we have a very good relationship with Hayground School, and I've talked to their kids and have showed them around Bridge Gardens, where we have a topiary garden. And the topiaries consist of different shapes or animals or figures, and the kids really love it, and John and I have a really good dialogue with the kids about it. So they are hosting this big food cart thing, but at the same time they're also hosting some sculpture arts from different artists. So I'll be working with them and just, you know, showcasing a few topiaries, living topiaries on site. So that should be fun to kind of create something whimsical and fun.
Do the kids get to do it?
The kids get to help out, yeah. I want to try and do something that's interactive, that they actually get to do something on that day. So I'm trying to find something that can take a beating and still look good. So, you know, it's I'm still doing my homework on it.
Sounds like fun.
But that event sounds like a lot of fun. I actually have a 4-foot weather balloon that I purchased online from a Kickstarter program that I'm using this summer in the fall with the school gardens to document the school garden space. And with this balloon comes like this website that you can upload the mapping images to, and so kids can see their garden from a 1,000-foot tether. And I plan on documenting when all those wagons come onto the Hayground property, so that should be kind of fun.
How many wagons do you think there will be?
I think there's more than 10. And more than 10 sounds like a lot already, so I'm just looking forward to have a little bit of the, you know, that urban feel to the suburbs out here.
Yeah, that should be fun.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun.
So you're also teaching a class called the Dye Plant Project in Amagansett. What's that?
The Dye Plants is from a dialogue that I have at Bridge Gardens. Again, this public garden has a very elaborate herb garden divided into four quadrants. You have your culinary herbs, your parsley, your basil, and lovage. You have your medicinal herbs. Echinacea is a very popular one, valerian. You have your ornamental herbs, herbs that are just, you know, you have a nice showy appearance, nice foliage, nice color. And then you have your textile herbs, so herbs that are used in a textile type of purpose to produce dye color or to wash fabrics. So that dialogue from Bridge Gardens, I'm now kind of bridging the gap, as they say, the two Amagansett applied arts. And they are an institution that are about textile designs and teach kids and adults about computer work, photography, silk screening, all those types of textile arts. I don't know how else to explain that. So I approach them to say, listen, I have seeds, I have plants, and I can produce dyes in a fun manner that can teach people that basic herbs can produce color. And that's where it starts.
What herbs will you be using for color? Like, I know you can use marigold, right, for
Use marigolds to produce kind of like a yellow, burnt amber color.
Saffron, but that's too expensive.
Yeah, well, the basics is dahlias are a great dye-producing plant. Saving onion skins is a very good producing plant from walking onions, which we have in our herb garden. Woad, which is a European type of dye plant that produces a blue color. And in fact, that woad was the original source of all the blue before indigo started to become very popular, shipping in from India.
Woad. How do you spell woad?
W-O-A-D.
Woad. Okay. Uh-huh.
Very beautiful plant. Blooms early spring, and then the seeds turn a dark black by about July. But you harvest the fresh leaves from the first year plant because it is a biennial, meaning that it needs to send up its leaves the first year, and then the second year it sends up its flower spike. So the woad leaves are harvested, and you can, you know, mineralizing it with different additives and mordants, you create a blue dye from it.
So you're using the leaves, not the flower, for the dye.
Yes, yeah, for that dye, for that color in particular, which is a very difficult color to produce. You need a lot of leaves and a lot of. It's a cooking process.
Uh-huh.
It's something that you should probably enjoy. You know, there is a cooking formula to all these different dye colors, and so some you get cook a little bit longer. Some you got to mix with different mordants. Tablespoon here, teaspoon there, and then you have a finished product afterwards.
Uh-huh. And what color, what flower do you use for, like, the reds?
The reds matter. M-A-D-D-E-R, which I purchase. I have not started that from seed. We have a limited space, and we use red. We produce coreopsis, the red flowering coreopsis.
Uh-huh.
Which you can buy from any seed store, and comes up very easily by midsummer. And if you produce enough, you can produce a small red dye.
Uh-huh.
Very interesting. It's a science and a cooking aspect that is the dialogue there. And there's a lot to learn. I know enough to feel comfortable teaching the kids. But as far as, you know, using it in a production warehouse, I'd have to go back to school for that one. But I'm sure there are other people that can, you know, take on that conversation. I just look to introduce it to the community out here.
Yeah, it's great. Well, I know, you know, as a Waldorf teacher, we always save the onion skins and dyed Easter eggs and dyed, you know, the linen fabric that we were making the all the drapes with. You know, we would use onion skins all the time. And I was always saving those for them.
Yes, Osage Orange. I've used that before, and that produces a beautiful yellow-gold color.
Uh-huh.
And there's a small Waldorf school out here for pre-K kindergarten and they use that Osage orange, and they use madder a lot. And they use use onion skins, and I've helped them out, and we're going to be doing some stuff this summer at one of their camps.
Oh, great. Great. So when we come back, I want to talk to you about the senses tour that you've been running also at the Bridge Gardens. But we're going to take a couple-minute break, and we'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Jeff Negron, who is the founder and operator of The Growing Seed, a business out on the east end of Long Island that is setting up, designing, and installing vegetable gardens for both residential and commercial properties. Jeff, are you back?
I'm here.
Great. So I know you were saying the public garden that you're working at is called Bridge Gardens in Bridgehampton. And I remember you telling me that you were going to be leading some tours called the Five Senses Tour. And I was wondering if you could share with my listeners what that is and what that's about.
Sure. The Botanic Land Trust is a not-for-profit organization that is in that isn't the job to preserve farmland. And they inherited this five-acre estate from two gentlemen who were avid gardeners, and Bridge Gardens is doing a great job of preserving this wonderful space in Bridgehampton Village. And it is run by Rick Bogish, who is the garden manager, and I work alongside with him. And we were just talking about different ideas to get the community to Bridge Gardens. And I just thought of a simple thing would be to start with the kids and the families and to show them that, you know, it's not just these particular gardens and all these little plants, but, you know, there's more to it. There are plants that you can touch and they're soft. There's stuff that, you know, obviously we have, there's thorns and plants, and there's stuff that you can taste, and there's stuff that you can visually see the true color of something, and then you put it somewhere else, and it changes a little bit. So the idea there is just to invite the community to bring their family and take the hour to explore the garden in a different type of way. You know, let's get off the path, let's touch the plants, let's hug the plants, let's see what type of feeling we can get out of it, and hopefully it's a fun one.
And is this a one-time event, or is this an ongoing series?
Well, I'd like to do it ongoing. That would be wonderful. You know, it depends on the crowd, and for right now, for this year, it is a one-time event.
And when
but
is
I have
it?
Been, it? This is July 22nd, I believe. I'm not too sure right hand offhand, but it is late July. You can go to pecanicalandtrust.org, and you find Bridge Gardens within that website, and you can get the schedule for the month of July.
And when did the Pecanic Land Trust acquire Bridge Gardens? Is that new?
Yeah, this was 4 years ago. It was donated to them by two gentlemen who still live in the area, but they were just, they grew tired physically. And they just felt that Pecanic Land Trust was the better fit of an organization that would be able to preserve the space. It's a wonderful space. I encourage everybody to take a visit there. We are gifted with two other national gardens, Madu Gardens in Sycophonic and the Longhouse in East Hampton. And the Bridge Gardens is really fitting right in. The response so far by the community has been great and at times very welcome.
Well, Quail Hill is also part of the Pecanic Land Trust, isn't it?
Yes, yes. They are the founding, you know, they are the face of Pecanic Land Trust, yes.
I don't know if you heard, you know, my talk at the beginning of today's session, but I was talking about some struggles I'm having in my own personal garden. I have some peppers and I have some eggplants that are just stubborn. They're not growing. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you had any tips for me. I don't know exactly what I should be amending my soil with to really enhance the nutrients that these particular plants need.
Yeah, of course. I get that question quite a few times. The first thing I'd start off with is, you want to do a soil test to reveal what type of soil content you have regarding organic matter. If you've been gardening for a few years in the garden space, garden soil does get a little tired, so it could use a boost with either some organic fertilizer or with some extra minerals. It maybe is pH, low or high. Maybe you're missing some micronutrients. And a soil test that you could source with a Cornell Cooperative in New York will reveal something that you may be missing. That being said, after that, there are some basic cultural stuff. Sometimes when you're purchasing eggplants, the tomatoes, peppers, they come with the fruit on them. And many of the times, that is the first one that's selected. The idea is that, I have the first pepper, I already bought this, it already has two tomatoes on it. But what gets overlooked is that that plant has been, it's pushing out that vegetable in a dire straits to at least set a seed and hopefully set its seed and continue on through the seed. It's stressed. So my recommendation is to remove all the fruits and flowers from your plant. Plant it with a little bit of Epsom salts, a little bit of compost, and, of course, a little bit of organic fertilizer, and water it. Keep it watered, and you should have a very healthy plant in about 5-6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
That is probably the number one thing, and it always tends to be a little bit more cultural than it is more soil. But a soil test will reveal the soil, and if you just follow those basic cleanup steps as you're planting it and give it a little bit of food, the Epsom salts is great. Because
that's magnesium?
Yes, it actually helps. Sometimes when you do have that fruit, setting that small fruit on that small plant, you usually get a kind of like a rotten bottom, and that's a calcium deficiency. Planting with a little bit of Epsom salt at the time that you're digging it in will help that plant receive a little bit of that micronutrient, so that fruit, if there are any on it, will at least have a little bit of extra boost to provide that first fruit, and hopefully you don't get that calcium rot.
Okay, well, if you already have the plants in the garden, do you recommend digging them up, putting the Epsom salt and the compost in, and then replanting them? Or should I just do it around the base of the plant and
exactly.
Finger it in?
Scratch around it, around the soil, take a teaspoon of the Epsom salts and sprinkle that around. Or you can do a foliar spray. Put it in one of those old Windex bottles and spray the foliage every 10 days.
Oh, I have a whole backpack foliage sprayer.
yeah, exactly. So you could use that. And I'm exploring that idea of using a foliar spray with Epsom salts this year. And we'll see what results that leads to.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's it's so heartwarming sometimes to hear someone I consider an expert also experimenting, because I think that's a lot of what it is experimenting, trial and, trial,
yeah,
see how it works.
There's so many knowledgeable people out there sharing so much information. It's fun to try out each one. I'm fortunate that I get to try it out at different locations, so I can probably get a quicker result as to what works or what doesn't. Another one I'm trying out is chamomile tea. I have grown chamomile plants throughout many gardens this year, and I'm drying it, and I'm, producing a tea with it. And the idea is that actually helps prevent fungus from developing on tomatoes, especially. We have a late blight out here on the east end of Long Island that wipes out potatoes and tomatoes. And it's been affecting us pretty hard for the past couple of years. And so this year I decided to grow chamomile and to brew my own tea and to see what type of results I'll get from it.
And do that as a foliage spray?
I do that as a foliar spray with a little bit of Epsom salts and the water. So right now, all the plants are green, but the late blight really comes in probably about mid to or late July.
So will you do this foliage spray to try to prevent the blight from coming, or you're going to wait to see if it comes and then do it?
No, it's the best is to do it as before it arrives, because once that fungus
prophylactically,
once that fungus does hit, it's pretty vicious and quick. You can tell that your plant has it, and the proper thing to do is to destroy it. It is a very bad pathogen that can overwinter in the soil through plant debris or in your compost or your garden waste. So the proper thing is to dispose of that plant, which is the hardest thing for any gardener to do. So once I see it, I will rip out the tomato. That's the dedication that you have to have. You know, you just have to do the good thing and get rid of that plant and try something else in that space.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You know, and in that manner, that is another thing I'm trying out. I'm trying out tomatoes that produce fruit all at once, early in the season. So I'm exploring that idea with a few gardens. I'm at one restaurant now where I planted patio tomatoes, the little short dwarf ones.
Uh-huh.
An early girl tomato I planted, and celebrity. So my only hope is just to at least get one nice crop out of each one of those plants. And if that blight comes by August, so be it. At least I have that one bumper crop from that plant, and I can at least say it was worth the effort that I went through. What I find is that the heirloom tomatoes take so long to produce that they get hit by this blight, and then your fruit ends up looking ugly as well. So I don't know. It's just an idea that I've been seeing that all these different varieties of tomatoes, and so might as well take advantage of them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I have a whole bunch of different ones as well. Of course, my labeling's not great, so I couldn't swear which is which, but I have a good idea. And
yeah, you know, once the fruit sets, I tend to identify things that way as well. If not, I'd be using a lot of wooden stakes.
Right, right. So if you were to share with my audience the three most important tips on how to start a garden, what would they be?
Well, first of all, it would be sight. It's very important that the garden gets full sun. As soon as you get beyond that part sun, shady area, which is anything less than 4 hours of sun, you will see plants start to slow down a lot. You won't be able to harvest every, 7 days, 6 days.
Mm-hmm.
It'll take a good 2 weeks for that plant to bounce back and so you can harvest from it again if it were to be one of those type of plants. So full sun, the site would be number one thing. Number two thing would be more of the personal type of endeavor, which is don't go overboard. You know, go at it really slow. Find something that you know you're going to use and find the space appropriate for that. And don't feel obligated to fill in all the space all at once. That's probably the number one thing I go to when I consult gardens, is that all the space has been occupied by one thing or another. And obviously that encourages disease or, pests to hide out. And when I see space in the garden, I know that, there's air movement. I can walk around freely. And those two things kind of to start to work into a garden that you can maneuver around, you can reach something properly, you can see that air is passing through everywhere, so you don't encourage any bad things regarding disease or fungus to happen.
Uh-huh.
And the number three thing is to explore your palate. Maybe you didn't grow up growing broccoli or eating broccoli or growing kohlrabi or eating kohlrabi, but give it a try. You know, you don't know until you try it. And there are a lot of easy vegetables, and there are a little bit more harder vegetables. And if you're comfortable growing some easy stuff, move up and get a little challenge going. And that's what kind of encourages me then in August when I was first starting out to then go out and check it out and really play around.
Uh
Those would probably be the big three.
Right, right. Last year I grew for the first time burdock root.
That was
great because it's hard to get burdock. I mean, you know, one time you might be able to get it at Whole Foods and then they won't have it for weeks and then you can get it again. And it stores really well. So, you know, growing some, it, you know, lasted a long time.
That's great. You have to give me some tips because the Topping Rose Inn would like to grow some of that.
Oh, it's great. Yep. Be happy
to. I'm looking forward to that. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that challenge as well. And horseradish, I'd never tried, which I look forward to trying.
Right. Yeah, I've never tried that either. So you were the recipient of one of the recipients of the Joshua Levine Award or grant for being a farmer to help school gardens?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Very happy to talk about that. Josh Levine Memorial Foundation was created when Josh, a young farmer in the area, was tragically killed through a tractor accident at Quail Hill Farms.
Yeah.
And
his family.
Yeah, it was very shocking. It was the end of the summer type of thing. It was in fact winter, so it was very shocking, to say the least. Anyways, that was the reason why the family came up and said that we would like to offer this grant, $10,000. And they worked with Slow Food East End to put out the word that they're looking for recipients. And I'm happy to say that I am one of those recipients. And my job is to work with some of the South Fork schools in either encouraging dialogue to start a garden or further enhancing the dialogue to get the garden involved in some sort of curriculum dialogue or some sort of after-school program to get the kids involved in the garden.
Well, that's great because I've also been working with some schools, and I just think if you can coordinate curriculum and gardens and giving kids more hands-on opportunity to experience learning with all of their senses, it's just remarkable and what comes out of that.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited as to where this can lead to for our community. And they just recently organized a curriculum workshop for all the schools. They're actually being hosted right now at Bridgehampton High School. And the teachers are working for 3 days on their own to develop a curriculum for K through 6, I believe, is the dialogue right now. So going into the fall season, we have enough ammunition to really take this a few steps forward. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Good. I'm sure they know of, like, the curriculums that are already out there, like Nourishing has a great curriculum.
No, they are aware of that, and
good.
The dialogue is starting from that point, so that helps.
Good, because that's
especially,
you know, K through 8, and that's, you know, great curriculum.
It's all about sharing, and, you know, for a lot of them, it's their first exposure, so there's a fine line to go at it, you know, full speed or...
Well, I have to say, one of the things I love about this community is that people are willing to share. You don't get the feeling like, you know, I have a secret and I don't want to share it with you. And, you know, it's really, there is a real collaborative effort going on. And that's really just so great. But we're running out of time, Jeff, and I want people to be able to get in touch with you if they have any questions about any of the things we've been talking about. Can you share your email with everyone?
Sure. My email address is thegrowingseed@gmail.com, and you can email me. I can answer any questions, or if you're out in the East End and you want to take a look at the restaurants, I can point you in direction. And I really appreciate the time that you took to bring me on your show. I'm really excited.
Thank you, Jeff. Well, you had some great information, and I definitely will be out there this summer, and I will come visit.
That's great. I wish you the best of luck. Thank you.
Thank you. Everybody out there who's been listening, thank you for joining us. If you have any questions, feel free to get in touch with me. And I look forward to being with you next week on the 4th of July.